Let's go ahead and be turning to Proverbs chapter 27. Proverbs 27. Seems like the end is in sight. We've been in Proverbs for quite some time, and 27 feels like it's close to the end. I think we still got a couple more months in it, but 27 seems close to the end, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay. So before we go any further, let's go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer, and then we will be starting on verse 11. Dear Lord, we come to you tonight. Just thank you for your blessings, and we thank you for this time that we have to be in church and sing praises to your name and to fellowship with one another, for us to consider you and your relationship to us and to consider your word. We thank you, Lord, for this study in Proverbs that we've been in and for the wisdom that we've gleaned and the instruction, Lord. I just pray that you would help use these studies and these verses, Lord, to shape the way that we think, the way we view the world, that we are able to be more discerning, more wise as a result of it. And Lord, I just pray that you would be with this church, that we can be a light and a witness in Longford and how these people need to know you, Lord. And Lord, I know we're in a place where there's so much going on and so much life that's happening that demands people's attention and getting caught up in materialism and works and or their work, their jobs and different things, Lord. And oftentimes they pay little attention to eternity, little attention to you. And I just pray, Lord, that you would open people's eyes, Lord. I pray that you'd soften hearts, Lord, that you'd turn their attention, their interest toward you, Lord. And I pray, Lord, that you would use us as a church, Lord, to be a witness, to be able to speak to them on your behalf, Lord, be your mouthpiece. Help us, Lord, tonight as we study, guide and direct us in your word. And Lord, use me tonight, I pray, in Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so we are on Proverbs 27, and we got through verse number 10 last week. So we'll pick up with verse 11 this week. And verse 11 says, "My son, be wise and make my heart glad, that I may answer him that reproacheth me." So he's talking to his son here, and I believe every parent's desire is for their children's success. And it's easy for us to say that if a parent is not desiring their children's success, they're not a good parent. I mean, that's simple enough, isn't it? So they want their children to make good decisions. They want them to walk with integrity. They want them to have good lives. I don't know that there's any parent that's going to say, "I hope my child doesn't have it as good as I did." I think every parent says, "I want my children to have it better than me." And with every generation, we are striving for our children to hand off a better world to our children than the one that we inherited, right? And that's kind of how we are seeking to do things. It's the way that it should be done. I don't know that every generation has succeeded at that. But anyway, we try. But because this is a parent's desire, the approach to parenting must be done with great care. We realize that so much hinges on how we raise our children. It hinges on the lessons that we teach them, the things that we allow, things that we don't allow. And so most good parents feel as if they are doing poorly or they wish they would have done better. So you find even the people that you would think of as being some of the best parents, and they'll say, "I don't know, I mess up an awful lot. I hope they turn out well." Mm-hmm. No. We've probably all heard that, right? Mm-hmm. And really, if you find someone who isn't too concerned about it or thinks that they are doing well, they probably aren't. And so the bad parents, really, they don't care. Part of the reason why good parents question is because of "the ones that reproacheth me." If you look at verse 10 or verse 11 again, it says that "I may answer him that reproacheth me." So to reproach means to criticize or to call out or to in some way put down, right? So if someone is a reproach, it means they're causing problems. Mm-hmm. That makes sense to everyone? And so he says, "I am imploring you, I am begging you to turn out wise so that I can breathe a sigh of relief, so that I can feel as if I did a good job, and so that all those who criticize me that were critical of me basically will have no reason to gloat over me." Mm-hmm. Right? "No, I told you so's," right? Yeah. Because with good parenting, they're constantly going to be having questions and criticism aimed at them. There's going to be the people who are saying, you're too strict. You need to ease up. You need to lighten up on your children. There's going to be all the comparison that's going on, right? Because I believe a good parent is going to try to be on top of things and try to guide their child, try to control some of the influences in their lives. And people are going to say, oh, just let them be kids. We've all heard that, right? You're going to have people that say, why won't you let them do that? Or why do you let them do that? It's going to be as if, kind of like whenever Jesus challenged the Pharisees, he said, you're like children children in the marketplace that's saying, we have piped and you have not danced, and we have wept and you have not, or we mourned and you have not wept. You remember that part in there? Mm-hmm. He's saying basically whatever we do, you're not satisfied with it. You keep playing games. And parenting really is a no-win situation. You're always going to have critics no matter which direction you go. And so constantly you're going to be evaluating how to handle things, what to allow, what to restrict. And it's far from science, but parents try to do their best. All the while that they are surrounded by all these critics. Mm-hmm. And some of the biggest critics can be the children themselves. They can be. You never let me do this. You just want to ruin my fun. Right? Yeah, that's one of them. So Solomon pleads with his children to choose the right path, the one of wisdom, to make sure that his heart ends up being glad. He says, I want to get to the end of all of this whenever my children are grown to be able to sit back and look and be glad for all the struggles I went through all the criticism I faced, through all the fighting and everything that's involved with raising children. He says, I want you to grow up and me to look at it and be glad. And finally be able to look at it and say, I think I did all right. And also so that it's a rebuke to the critics to prove them wrong. That's the part that I may answer him that reproach me. See, this is why I did this. This is why I did it that way. All of the struggles, all of the fights, all of these different things, it paid off. So that's one of the times that it's good to say, I told you so, right?
So
is
this Solomon telling David?
David was his father, so it'd be Solomon telling Rehoboam.
Rehoboam, gotcha.
Which ended up being a fool and didn't take any of this to heart.
So basically, live wisely so that I can go ahead and not join it, and then I can go back to anybody who watches me or something.
He's saying if you turn out well, then it validates everything that I've been doing.
Yeah.
It makes all the effort worth it. Mm-hmm. And it silences the critics that said how horrible of a parent I was, and then I can point to him and say, not so horrible now, huh?
Thanks so much for that one.
But if you think about it, in the world that we live in, everyone's always asking whenever you have grown children, so what does your children do? You know, so-and-so, how are they doing now? Oh, they went off to college, and they got a degree, and they're working in this field, and they're doing all of these things, and they're married to this person, they have these children, and things are going well. Okay, you can beam with pride. How's your child doing? Well, they should get out of prison in about 7 years. Completely different story, isn't it?
Yeah.
What did you do wrong?
And so, well, that's a very good point, because if you say, oh, my child, you know, they got out of school and they got their ducks in a row and they got their job and they got their family and things are going well. It's like, oh, good on them. They really worked hard. They went to prison. Well, what did you do? Right? Isn't that the way it goes? Because if the child turns out good, good on them. If the child turns out bad, you messed them up. And most parents aren't going to have any problem with that because they're going to be proud of that child. They're going to say, yeah, by all means, give them all the credit. I'll just sit back and smile.
Mm-hmm.
It's that part of that my heart might be glad.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they're doing all right.
Was it Rehoboam or Bud King?
Rehoboam was the one who, whenever he took the kingdom, they came to him and said, you know, Solomon taxed us heavily, put a lot of burdens on us. Make our life easier. We'll be glad to serve you. And he said, well, let me get back to you. And he asked the men who were counselors to his fathers, to Solomon. And they said, yeah, by all means, submit to them, be a servant leader to them. And they're going to love you. Your name's going to go down in history. They're going to love you more than Solomon. And then his friends that he was raised up with, the ones that were the same age as him, said, no, you're the king. Who are they to tell you what to do? You show them who's boss. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, that appeals to my pride. I like that. So I want to come out to them and say, you don't get a call the shots. I get a call the shots. If I want to make it worse on you, I'm going to make it worse on you. And they said, well, then we're not going to follow you. And he split the kingdom. And that's where you end up with, you know, the two tribes of Judah and the 10 tribes of Israel. Yeah, and so
he went against this verse.
Yeah, he went against that verse, and pretty much most of the book of Proverbs.
Yes.
And he had all of this wisdom, and he didn't avail of it. Which now we have all this wisdom, and the question is, will we avail of it?
Mm-hmm.
But it also highlights the point that the wisest man in the world can try his hardest to espouse the wisdom to his child. And his child is still a free moral agent and can choose whether he accepts it or rejects it and also deals with consequence. I could also say it's more complicated than that because Solomon was far from perfect.
Right.
And so we look at Solomon and, you know, there's an old saying, more is caught than taught. Mm-hmm. And Solomon saying, okay, beware of the strange women, but I'm married to 700 of them. You know, he can say, don't do this and don't do that. But then he did it, and his sons will follow in his footsteps. And, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes, he said, I basically searched out the meaning of life, and I amassed for me great riches, and that didn't satisfy. I went after seeking pleasure. I kept no good thing from myself. I just went out and partied it up. That wasn't it either. You know, I sought for it in relationships with women. I had all these love affairs and everything, and that never brought satisfaction. So finally, at the end of my life, I came to the conclusion that the whole duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. After I've tried everything else. And then what effect does that have on his children? Yeah, very much so. Do as I say, not as I do does not work.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he goes through all this and he says, I want you to turn out well. I want you to walk in wisdom so that one of these days when you're grown, I can beam with pride and I can be glad at the product of my effort. It wasn't in vain. And not only that, but all of my critics will be shown that they were wrong. Now, I will say, although this is a Bible verse, that is not the best way to approach things. Okay, and what I mean by that is you don't look at your children and say, you better turn out well so you don't make me look bad.
Right?
Behave yourself or it'll make me look bad. Right? Not the best way to go about it either. But part of the reason why I have to clarify that is that in today's world, there's a shift that's occurring. Okay? And that shift is going from the collective to the individual. For millennia, the way that society functioned, the way that it worked, was that people had a duty to observe, okay? The world around them determined who they were to be and what was right and what was wrong and their place that was in the world. And so they said, okay, this is what's expected of me. This is what my position is in the world. And so I'm going to find my role. I'm going to do what society is expecting me to do. And they were satisfied to do that. Okay, so as you're growing up, it's like, okay, what's expected of me? I'm going to grow up. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to get married. I'm going to raise a family. I'm going to be a productive member of society. I'm going to find my place. And that's what I'm supposed to be doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's traditionally in most cultures in the world. But what about now? How's things go? Rather than asking, what should I do? It's what do I want to do,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's become I-focused. It's become me-focused. It's very individual. And so what you do, it's not out of duty. It's not what's my part in society. It's out of desire.
Yeah.
Okay. And we were talking about that this week.
Mm-hmm.
And so with desire, it's decide what you want to do. Follow your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Find your way. Throw off everything. And this is like in every Disney movie, right? Throw off everybody else's expectation. Figure out who you are and make them accept it. Right? And so I want to be me. I want to do what I want to do. Who are you to tell me what to do? right? And so it becomes very me-centric. And that's damaging. It's harmful. But whenever we look at it in light of the verse, because there's a reason I'm looking at this, whenever we become so individualistic, whenever we become so self-centered, we forget that everything that we do, every part of our life, has a ripple effect on the world around us.
Yes.
That everything that we do, we are interconnected, and it has an effect on the people surrounding us.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever we say, I don't care what anybody else thinks, I don't care what anybody else's opinion is, I don't care what they say or what I'm going to do what I want to do, it still affects the people around you. And so this is one of the things that Solomon is saying is, I have tried to pour wisdom into you. I've tried to show you the right way, and I'm begging you to follow it because I know you can choose to go against it. I know you have a free will. I know you can turn away from that. But if you do, then it's going to bring shame upon me, and everybody around is going to be paying attention, and they're going to criticize, and they're going to see what a mess it ended up being. And so it's going to bring shame. It's going to bring a reproach upon me. It's going to bring a reproach on my family. And it's going to be a cautionary tale to everybody around.
Mm-hmm.
You know so-and-so's kid down the road? Yeah, look at how they turned out. Didn't see that one coming, did you? And I knew whatever he was letting them do this and that, I knew that's what it was going to turn, right? Okay, so Solomon says to grow up to be someone who is a credit to those who come before. A good way to put it? Okay, any questions or comments on that first verse? Okay, then, verse number 12. It says, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. There's an old saying that says, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Has everyone heard that? Do you know what it means?
I don't know the saying. It's better to prevent something from happening than it happening, and you have to heal or do damage controls.
Yeah, so a very simple example of this, you're driving down the road in your car, and the light comes on telling you that you're low on oil. You can ignore that light, keep on driving because the car's still running. But whenever it gets too low on oil and you blow the engine, it'd been a lot cheaper to buy a liter of oil and pour in your engine than it would be to replace your engine.
Or a new car.
Or a new car, right?
Yeah.
It's like this could have been, have you ever seen like those memes and those commercials and whatnot that says this could have been prevented?
Yeah.
I think we've probably all seen that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea behind it. One little thing could have prevented it. But they bypassed that one little thing, and it created a lot bigger problem, right? And so here it says that the prudent man foreseeth the evil. In order to foresee something, what has to happen?
You have to be alert.
You have to be alert. You have to be paying attention, right? You have to see it ahead of time. And so it says the prudent man is foreseeing. He is looking ahead, he is paying attention. The verse I often quote, see then that you walk circumspectly. You're watching all around, your head's on swivel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Circumspect, circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so a prudent man, or one that walks with wisdom and care, he's looking ahead, he's paying attention to what's going on, and he's going to prepare for the future. He's going to make plans. He's going to be avoiding hardships and avoiding disasters. And I know we can't be anxiety-ridden and trying to prevent every possible outcome. We can't know all things. But I think there is a reasonable amount of prevention. There's a reasonable amount of care, right? And so if you can see something coming, then it's a good idea to be paying attention so that you see it in time, that you're able to respond to it.
Yeah.
This is a good thing as far as being alert when driving. I know I already talked about cars a second ago. But whenever you're driving, if you are paying attention, it gives you time to respond to hazards.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're not paying attention, if you're texting or looking around or whatnot, the car in front of you stops, that's the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're paying attention, then you can hit your brakes in time and you avoid the accident.
Right.
Simple illustration, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the prudent man, the smart man, doesn't want a car accident.
Right.
The smart man doesn't want the injuries. He doesn't want the insurance premiums going up. He doesn't want the funeral. Okay? Whatever it may be. And so the smart man is paying attention. He's doing what he can, making sure that his car's in good repair, that he's able to stop in time. And I'm just keeping up the whole driving thing. But a prudent man is going to do what he can to prevent the bad things from happening. This comes in many forms in romantic relationships. It's looking for qualities and character and walking away when it becomes apparent that they're not right for you. Okay? Learning how to spot red flags, right? And acknowledging and responding to them instead of ignoring and dismissing them. Because it's a lot worse to keep plowing forward, end up married to that person, and regret you ever did, than it is to say, yeah, this isn't working. And it also comes in jobs and business partnerships. It's gauging values and directions in determining whether to begin or continue with them. So if you're considering a specific job, you're paying attention, you're saying, okay, if I take this job, then I see these things that could be a potential problem. Are they a big enough problem for me to reject the job? Right? Or are they something that I just need to prepare for in that job? You see those things. Or if it's a business partnership, it's, okay, the person or the business that I am partnering with, what is their values? What are the things that's important? What is the direction they're going in? Because if they're going a different direction, if their values don't align with mine, I probably shouldn't be partnered with them. Right. The Bible warns against being unequally yoked with unbelievers. We always just apply that to marriage, right? But anytime that you are yoking with something, you are binding yourself together with something. That's a business partnership as well, right? And so if I try to go in business with somebody whose values do not align with mine, we're going to constantly be having trouble with trying to figure out the direction for the business. If I want to walk in integrity and they don't mind being a little bit crooked and bending the rules, we're going to have problems with that, right? And so you're looking at these things and you're evaluating and saying, if I go forward in this, there's going to be problems. There's going to be heartaches. There's going to be issues. I'm going to have to face this. And so I need to make provision now or avoid it altogether. The whole business thing, it could be a matter of drawing up a contract and having a business plan and saying, okay, this is how things are going to be conducted. This is how we're going to deal with these things. We're going to make sure that we handle it this way so that we prevent these things later on down the road. Because as we're talking about the things that we can prevent, there's always going to be things that we can't foresee. There's always going to be all these eventualities that there's no way that we can predict. But it behooves us to take care of the ones that we can so that they're not adding to the pile with all the ones that we can't. Okay? Going back to the whole thing with relationships, romantic partnerships and stuff, there's going to be plenty of problems down the road. There's going to be plenty of things you learn about each other that you'll have to deal with then. But there are plenty of them that you can figure out about before to save the hassle later on. I know I've done a decent amount of thinking about premarital counseling and different things lately because of stuff that's going on. And a common theme that I find is that a lot of issues within marriage could have been prevented had the two discussed things and gotten on the same page before they ever got married. Okay? Well, we never talked about kids. We never talked about if this happened. We never talked about how we were going to raise them or what kind of discipline we were going to do. Or we never discussed finances or never realized how we handled money. Or, you know, there's all these things that we have to figure out that a prudent man is going to look at ahead of time and either make provision for, preparation for, or avoid altogether. Just in financing, a prudent man is going to be budgeting. He's going to be exercising discipline with these finances. He's going to be putting provision in place to safeguard against future events. If a person sees their paycheck coming in, I know there's not checks anymore, but your direct deposit now, I guess. You see your money coming in and you have no idea how you're going to spend it. You just, as soon as it hits, you're already going through it, plowing through it like there's no end to it. And then by the time the end of the month comes along, you have no money. And you do that week after week, month after month, year after year, never budgeting, never setting things aside. First time the car breaks down or the rent goes up, or there's a health issue, or something happens, then your world is in a tailspin because you didn't make provision for things that would come later on down the road. You acted like there was nothing to worry about, nothing to prepare for, right? And so it says, a prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself. So there's this protection, this hedge that he's putting up because he foresees it. He's paying attention. He's like, you know what? One of these days, this is going to happen. I better prepare for it now. You know, the car I'm driving, 300 some thousand kilometers on it, thing's not going to last forever. I better be saving some money because one of these days I'm going to buy another car. Right? One of these days my kid might get sick, have to take him to the doctor, might have to, I better have some money set aside. Right? Prudent man. But what's the last half of that verse? It says, but the simple pass on and are punished. I'll just take things as they come. Cross that bridge when we get there. You've heard that, right? But whenever we say, I'll cross that bridge when we get to it, there's a couple assumptions. Okay? One of the assumptions is that there'll be a bridge. And you know, in order for there to be a bridge there, someone had to build it. You know who wasn't building it? The one who said, we'll cross it when we get to it. That makes sense to everyone? So if we approach life willy-nilly as if, okay, whatever happens will happen. Life will take care of itself. We'll sort it out whenever it happens. Then you're going to end up having stresses and problems and breaking points. You're going to be facing plenty of rivers that have no bridge there because you didn't build it before you got to it. And so we can't just see what happens and carelessly move forward until something happens. Because as I said, you're going to get to the bridge that you were going to cross later on and realize it's not there. Okay, any questions or comments on that one? Okay, we'll keep on going then. Take his garment that is surety for a stranger, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman. Okay, so Solomon has talked to her about quite a bit, this idea of surety. Okay, do you guys remember, understand what surety is? Mm-hmm. Okay. It would be a security on a loan, right? Mm-hmm. You borrow something and you have to put up surety. You have to have collateral. It would be a more modern word, right? And so a common thing then is if you borrowed something, you would have to give something of value to ensure, surety, that you were going to return, that you were going to repay. Mm-hmm. That was the idea behind it. And so in verse number 13, Solomon is offering two examples of the simple man in verse 12. Remember the simple that goes forward and is punished? Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got two of them here. The one who is careless with his money, the other one that's careless with his relationships. The one who chases the strange women and the one who blows his money.
Right.
And so Solomon's already written about surety several times in chapter 6 and verse 1, in 11 and 15, which I'm going to turn over and read. And then in chapter 17 and verse 8 and in 20 and verse 16 are all ones that he talks about surety. But in 11 and 15, it says, he that is surety for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth suretyship is sure. So he says, if you stand good for somebody else's debts, it's going to come back to hurt you. You'll smart for it. But if you hate suretyship, you stay away from it, then you are sure. You're safe. So we kind of get an idea of what Solomon's views on suretyship is. He says, if you're going to be surety for a stranger, if you're going to be careless with your finances, then stupid should hurt, right?
Yeah.
And so this is kind of an extension of this. He's still saying stupid should hurt. When a man proves himself to be so financially foolish. A wise man should not seek to alleviate the consequences. That makes sense? I mean, we tend to feel sorry for people. We see people struggling. We see people, as they say, down on their luck, right? But then we realize how they got there. And this isn't us being hard-hearted. This isn't us being unmerciful. But we need to realize that whenever people have patterns, whenever people continually behave foolishly, that foolishness has built-in consequences. And we do no favors to someone in shielding them from those consequences. Because a lot of times that's the only ways they're going to learn. And I think a lot of times we become enablers. Okay, if you continue to try to shield someone from the consequences of their bad actions and their bad decisions, then you're going to keep paying the price that they were meant to pay. And how's that right? And so Solomon's advice for dealing with such a person, one that is foolish in his finances and his relationships, he says, don't give unsecured loans to unstable people. Don't just be handing out money to people who have already proven themselves to be untrustworthy. So if you got somebody who borrows money and says, I'll pay you back, and that's been years ago, and they still haven't paid you back, and then they come and say, loan me some money, I'll pay you back later, then you're entering into the category of the fool by continuing to do that, right? Because they're going to continue using you as their ATM. And so just because they're foolish doesn't mean that you have to have something to protect your interest when they fail to pay. This is the idea of the suretyship. It's like, yeah, sure, I'll give you this money, but I need a little bit of collateral while you give me. Okay, I don't know exactly what you'd have here. I know I've known people in the States. It was like, hey, I need to borrow $500 to payday. It's like, can you leave your shotgun with me?
Yeah.
I know guns aren't a thing here, but there, you know, I need something. Let me hold the title to your car.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until you pay me back. And they'll say, nah, I don't think I'll do that. Well, you had no intention of paying me back, did you? Right? Is this something that's...
I mean, a lot of people at home would do pawn shops like that. There's nothing like that here, is there?
I don't think that it's common here. But even,
it'd be a hit though. It would be.
But for instance, if you're looking at, you know, someone to do business with or someone who is wanting to, someone that you're going to take a gamble on, okay? You don't want it to be someone who has a history of bad decisions. It's like, yeah, I just saw you coming out of the bookie, out of the bet shops, and then you come to me to ask for money. Where there was a lady that was walking down the street the other day trying to beg money off of everybody. And she had a pack of smokes and a Red Bull sticking out of her purse. It's like, you know, the money that you're asking from me, if you would have used that on it instead, you would have had it. Everybody still on board with this?
Yeah.
Okay.
If a person is foolish enough to go ahead and guarantee a stranger's debt, right? They should be held accountable for that, essentially. Right?
So yeah.
You don't know them, why are you guaranteeing it? Because it's just basic poor judgment from their part.
Right. And so don't take the consequences on yourself for their poor judgment.
Yeah.
So I think another thing that this teaches as well, and like I said, we have to look at it in the context of when it was being written. But another thing is that whenever they fail to pay, you need to stick to the terms. It's like, oh, I know you didn't pay, but I'll go ahead and give this back to you.
No.
No. Give me an extension. Give me more time to pay. Like, we had a contract. You said if you didn't pay back for it by this time, I kept that. It's mine now. Right?
So the early models of banking, right?
What is it?
It's the early models of banking.
Yeah. Because they didn't have banks, so the people who were wealthy were the ones that were loaning out, and a lot of them would have been I know that it's common to vilify the wealthy, you know, eat the rich, that whole thing. But a lot of wealthy people would also be generous people. And so everyone's coming and saying, give me more time, give me more to pay, you know, loan me this, loan me that. And it's like, there's got to be some boundaries in place here. And so he says, if you're paying attention and this guy is behaving foolishly, if he's going out and the part at the end of that where it says, and take a pledge of him for a strange woman, this is talk about his relationships. If he is chasing after women, because that usually goes together, poor financial decisions and poor relational decisions. Chasing after women that drain his bank account and he drains it on her and everything. It's like, I can't pay my light bill because I went out and I bought this for her. I took her on this trip. And it's like, yeah, you're a fool. Light bill comes first. You have to feed and have a heat before you spend money on extra stuff, right? Remember, the prudent man foresees the future. He prepares for it. That guy didn't prepare. And so why should he eat into my preparation? And I know this sounds a little bit cold, a little bit callous, right? It is. It's life. Because we think, oh, we're Christians. We need to be generous. But I'll tell you, if you are not discerning in these things, you will have nothing to be generous with. Because a lot of times everyone else, and I'm not saying do not be charitable. I'm not saying do not give to the needy. Right. But I'm saying if the person, every time that they get a little bit of money, absolutely blows it, every time they just absolutely run through it, then why are you letting them run through yours too? Mm-hmm. And they will continue to do it as long as you allow them.
Mm-hmm. And expects us to be, I'm looking for a word, but I can't remember it at the moment.
Good stewards.
Yeah, exactly. And and being able to discern with some people is part of being a good steward.
Yeah. Well, and one of the principles that I've often mentioned is I don't give people money. Like beggars and stuff, I don't give them money, but I will give them food. And there's been several times like, I'm really hungry. I haven't eaten. And I'm like, hey, what do you need? And I'll go in, I'll load them up. I'll get them staples. I'll get them, you know, lunch meat, and I'll get them bread, and I'll get them fruit, and I'll get them a case of water. And I'll be like, eat, here you go. Right? Be like, okay, I'll set you up. But I'm not going to give you, you know, 10 or 15 euros to go and hit the bet shop or get cigarettes or alcohol. I'm not paying for that. But I'll help someone be fed. Okay, so as I said, it's not meant to be cruel or unmerciful. We're not oppressing the poor or the disadvantaged, but we are making sure that we're not footing the bill for other people to make poor financial and relational decisions. And as I said, whenever we do that, we become an enabler. We just continue that. And so sometimes people have to hit rock bottom so they can look up. And they're not going to do that as long as mommy and daddy continue funneling money to them. They're not going to do that as long as, you know, brother or sister continues bailing them out every time that they get in trouble. They're not going to, if constantly they have somebody who is preventing their bad decisions from coming fully to their consequences. And so the way this plays out today is whenever a person continues, as I said, to bail someone out who behaves irresponsibly or paying their light bill, their car note after they've wasted their paycheck, continuing funneling money to someone with an addiction. And I think it also should apply to a lot of government programs because the government's one of the biggest enablers. And I realize that a lot of that is a bit controversial, but it's biblical. And so Solomon's telling his son, if you see people out there who can't handle their money, don't give them yours. Easy enough principle. Any questions or comments on that one? I'm not going to get very far today. That's okay. Okay, verse number 14. It says, he that blesseth his friend with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, it shall be counted a curse to him. Anyone ever have a loudmouth friend? Loudmouth daughter. But the idea in this, it's talking about the friend who rises early and boasts loudly. And they're not boasting about themselves. They're boasting about you.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, everybody wants a friend like that. Someone who speaks kindly, speaks well of me. But it says here at the end of the verse that it shall be counted a curse to him. And so what this verse is highlighting is the effort and intensity of the praise. He rises early, uses a loud voice, which lets us know that it's probably also phony. Right? We've all heard that usually it's the empty wagon that is the loudest. You've heard that, the illustration on that? Some of you haven't. Well, there was a father and a son, and they could hear a rumbling in the distance. And the father asked the son, he said, do you know what that is? He says, yeah, that's the sound of a wagon. And the father says, yeah, and it's empty. And the boy says, how do you know it's empty? And he says, empty wagons make the most noise. Okay? That applies to people too. Because that illustration was never about wagons. But a lot of times the most loud and noisy people are the ones that are the emptiest, have the least to offer. A lot of times they make all the noise because of what they are lacking. But anyway, we like to be honored. We like to be praised within reason. But what this is talking about is unreasonable.
Right.
If you see someone who is making a big deal, who is loud and boisterous, trying to draw attention to somebody else, what's the thought that comes to your mind?
What are they hiding?
Because a lot of times it is taking the attention off themselves and putting it on you. Right? And so they are trying to get people to look at you, but probably not for the right reason. It could be so that they're not looking at them because they're trying to hide something. Or it could be because they are trying to pin something on you. It could be because they are trying to flatter you. Going out and broadcasting, oh, Bron is the greatest fella ever. Oh, he's this and he's that. And just proclaiming and going out and telling everybody about my buddy Brian. And if I started doing that, you know, the first time or two, it might be great, right? Yeah. You might be saying, well, that's quite loud, okay? I'm not sure why you're so excited about this. But after a while, it's going to be like, okay, what are you after? What's your angle? What are you trying to prove? What are you trying to gain?
For how much are you paying him?
And so this idea of someone rising early, so that's their, you know, the effort they're putting into it, right? Because people don't get up early for anything unless they're really serious about it, right? Unless they're really wanting something about it, right?
So basically good works delivered with bad timing and lose their goodness.
What is it?
Good works delivered with bad timing and lose their goodness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Excellent saying goes along with this. And so part of the whole idea of rising early could also be that they are, getting back to the whole idea of timing, whenever they are speaking hastily, okay, before things have panned out, whenever you're just getting started, right? Before you're proven. And so what ends up happening with that is whenever you start hearing this, you start believing it, and they inflate your head so big that you can't go forward. It becomes a curse to you. It's good to have people on your side, people in your corner, have a cheerleader or two. But if you have people who are inflating your ego, they're going to destroy you. If you have people bragging on you without reason or out of measure, it's going to be damaging to you. You ever see a child who could do no wrong? Their parents were always bragging on them, that no one could say a cross word to them, and they were the best of everything, and they were below mediocre. What effect does it have on that kid?
Jerk.
Yeah. And you end up with kids that are full of ego, you end up with adults that are full of ego that think they're God's gift to this world whenever they're not God's gift to anyone. And whenever it's that way, it has destroyed them. Those kind words, those good words, that blessing becomes a curse. And so a lot of times, the praise that people heap upon you is more detrimental to you than the criticism. I mean, we value praise, but here's the thing, okay? And maybe this is me meddling a bit. But in child training now, you can't correct, you can't criticize, it's all praise, right? All this positive, gentle parenting stuff. And what happens is the child's never corrected. They're never reproved for anything. And the first time that someone pushes back against them, they just fold like a cheap chair. I mean, that's what happens. And so all of that blessing ends up being a curse. So here's the thing. If it is not genuine, it's going to come back to bite you. Because a lot of times you're going to find that your biggest cheerleaders when things are going good will be the ones that leave the quickest when they go bad. A lot of times the loudest ones are the fair weather ones. Because when you're doing a good job, they're going to cheer you on. But as soon as you mess up, they're either out or they're going to criticize you. So don't bank on that type of person. Okay. So even if there's no ill intent, your loudest supporters will be the first to abandon you when things get tough. But what you should desire, what you should value, is a sincere and faithful friend. Not the one who is loud and boisterous, but the one that is constant, consistent, faithful. And so, like I said, the extravagant, undeserved praise is going to have negative effects on a person. Loud praise inflates ego, sets you up for failure. And so beware of the boastful, even if they're boasting about you. Okay, so we got to stop there for tonight. Does anyone have any questions or comments on that last verse or any of them that we've looked at? Okay.